What's up? Word of Mouth Wednesday. Word up. This is the Word of Mouth Wednesday. My name's Daniel Libby, and we're back here for another Wednesday, 7 to 8 p.m. Word of Mouth. Word up. We've got a big show lined up tonight. This ain't Canada no more. Well, we're wondering about government secrets and special issues of the media and democracy. We're going to be discussing tonight how the G20 Toronto exposed that this ain't Canada right now. Joining us today in the studio, returning, is a return guest, Derek Sobral. He's going to be on the show, and plus by phone, we're going to be speaking with Paul Figueroas about the liberation topic, and then it's also going to be talking about, is the world being controlled by a ruthless and monolithic conspiracy? That is a question we're going to be asking, and we're going to be actually going to try to play one of the greatest speeches in its entirety almost 50 years later, the President and the Press, JFK's speech about, democracy, freedom, and the secret society conspiracies. And first up, we're going to be playing from Robin Yento a clip on the Atomic Energy of Canada Limited situation on the atomic energy and nuclear issues, an interview with Sean Patrick Stencil, nuclear energy campaigner for Greenpeace. So all that and more coming up today on the Word of Mouth Wednesday. You're listening to CKLN 88.1 FM. Word up, word of mouth. Word is bond. Word up. First up, we're going to be playing that interview, though, from Robin Yento, set in by the longtime volunteer here at CKLN, Robin Yento, about the AECL. Here is an interview with Sean Patrick Stencil. Word up.
The big news this past week has been the near collapse of the McGuinty government's energy plan. The Premier's plan to power Ontario rested on nuclear energy, whose future was put into question last week by the failure of the federal government to find a buyer for its atomic energy crown corporation called the AECL, or Atomic Energy of Canada Limited. With the collapse of private sector bids, the nuclear crown corporation has no one willing to take on its multi-billion dollar costs and risks of building new nuclear plants in the province. To clarify what the failed AECL sale means to the Ontario government's energy plan is Sean Patrick Stencil from Greenpeace. Sean Patrick says the provincial government's nuclear crisis presents a new opportunity for Premier McGuinty to redo his energy plans to include more wind, solar, and geothermal energy.
Why does McGuinty's nuclear crisis mean a green opportunity for him?
Well, about 5 years ago, the McGuinty government committed to one of the largest nuclear build programs in the world. It would require rebuilding our entire fleet of CANDU reactors, as well as building additional reactors. And the reason they agreed to do this was because they were told by an advisory committee that it would be the cheapest option for Ontario. And what we've seen over the past 5 years, though, was that it was bad advice, that the actual cost of not only rebuilding reactors, but especially for building new reactors, was way out of proportion with what they were told. So they were told new reactors would cost about $6 billion for two reactors. And what was reported in 2009 was that the actual cost was $26 billion, which was supposed to be the original sum for the entire plan. Now, what this means is the government's been trying to get a huge subsidy out of the federal government to try and build this what's called a prototype advanced CANDU reactor. And there's a lot of blame game going on between the province and the feds about, I'm not going to build this reactor because you won't subsidize it, and vice versa. This is actually an opportunity, though, not for the nuclear industry, but for the green industry. Because these reactors are so expensive, we can be looking at more cost-effective options. Why try to get a huge subsidy out of the federal government when we could be developing options here in Ontario that have already started to grow, but are in fact blocked by the government's 2005 nuclear commitment? It said we're going to keep nuclear at about 50% of supply. What that means is the glass is half full and you can only expand green energy so much, and they put a cap on green energy at about 13% of supply over the long term, well behind other jurisdictions in the world.
Can you talk a bit about the costs of green energy? Because just today I think there was some mention in the, I think in the Globe and Mail, about the costs of green energy and how expensive it is, and also the same thing's been coming out from the Sun, from the Toronto Sun. Can you just address the question of the cost of green energy compared to nuclear?
Well, very good question. One of the good things the government's done is enacted something called a feed-in tariff policy, which says to entrepreneurs or communities or cooperatives that if you can put up a windmill, we'll pay you a certain fixed rate for that supply. And this is the policy that's worked in Germany and Spain and kickstarted a renewable industry there. And the issue at hand is, at face value, the prices paid for, say, wind power right now are more expensive than what we're paying on our electricity bill. We've never paid the real cost on our electricity bill. So when we say the green energy is more expensive that's coming online, it's not quite true. And one of the reasons for that is we've never, with the nuclear supply, we've never got a full costing in there of, for example, the cost overruns when they were built, or the cost of managing the waste created by these reactors over a million years. So those aren't factored into the cost that we're paying on our bill. But what's the good news is that these costs that are coming on, the plants or the renewables that are coming on light right now, the way this policy is structured is that over time, those prices are going to be reviewed and ratcheted down. So while we may be paying 13 cents for wind right now, next September they'll do a review and guaranteed they're going to reduce that price because the industry will be established and there'll be an economy of scale because factories will be up and running and they'll be able to bring that cost down. And that's what we've seen happening in Europe is, unlike the nuclear industry, the renewable industry is innovating and bringing their cost down. So over the long term, that's the good investment.
The provincial government claims that we need to support nuclear to support 70,000 jobs in Ontario. What do you say about that?
Well, sure, we have people working at the reactors. We have about 20, well, not 20 actually, about 16 left operating. And those jobs, those people are there. One thing that needs to be factored in is we could be looking at a just transition for those workers because a lot of them, about 50%, are set to retire over the next 5 years. So it's actually a good time to be ratcheting down our support for nuclear. And other people that are still working in the industry could be put to work cleaning up those reactors and decommissioning jobs. Meanwhile, the renewable industry, we did a study last year with the Pemin Institute and the Canadian Environmental Law Association showing that investing in a portfolio of green supply, so conservation, you know, the windmills, combined heat and power, local generation, would in fact create more jobs for less money than building new reactors. So we also need to ask the question of, like, what, you know, we want to create jobs, how do we do it cost effectively, and what's best for the province over the long term. When we invest in green jobs, that's jobs all across the province. When we invest in nuclear jobs, it tends to be just jobs in Durham Region.
Well, let's just keep talking about jobs here and training. What, because I know there's the green energy type of future, or green energy revolution that Greenpeace talks about. What would that mean in the short term for workers in Ontario? How many, what is the vision of that in terms of numbers of workers in a green energy type of economy?
Well, the government puts out numbers, for example, that its current policies will create about 50,000 jobs. And they've done some smart things within their feed-in tariff, which will require suppliers to build factories here. If you put a solar panel on your roof, you have to buy one that is sourced with parts built in Ontario. So that's creating jobs right now. There are factories being built in Guelph and Windsor, down in Tilsonburg, that weren't around just 3 years ago. So these are new industrial jobs. And I would note in the automotive belt, where we've lost a lot of jobs over the past 5 years, that are being created. So that phase-in over time can mean quite a bit. Germany today gets over 260,000 jobs in the renewable industry. And they initiated their feed-in tariff system about 10 years ago. And they also get about 30% of their power right now from nukes, but they're phasing that out. Again, over time, they're having to transition to a different energy system, getting people off the dirty jobs and bringing them onto the clean jobs.
If you could let me know, or let us know, not too long, but just give us an idea of why nuclear isn't a green source of energy, and why nuclear is actually not helping us when it comes to climate change.
Well, I'll give you two words. One is radioactive waste. So our nuclear plants in Ontario have created about 35,000 tons of high-level radioactive waste. It's currently stored on site, but is going to be a threat to the environment and human health for a million years. That's an intractable problem that we've created. And I think just based on that, you can't call this a green source of energy. We can create that same power in different ways without creating that radioactive waste. The other thing I would say is this is the 25th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster. And that's an example of how this industry can go drastically bad and hurt the environment and hurt human health. There was a 30-kilometer zone around the Chernobyl reactor that was depopulated after that accident. And the industry always claims it's safe, that the probability of such accidents are low. But, you know, the industry can insure itself. They require special legislation to protect it in the case of an accident. So they won't pay if they hurt you in an accident. They won't have a responsibility to pay the full cost. So I think on those two grounds right there, this is not a green industry. Regarding the climate change front, well, there's only so much money to go around. And if you have only so much time and so much capital to stop climate change, you're going to want to use it the most cost-effectively and in the most timely fashion. And building a nuclear plant costs a lot more than investing in green sources. You're getting less power for your dollar. And it takes at least 10 years to build a reactor. So even if we started building a reactor today, it would not help us whatsoever in stopping dangerous climate change. We need to stop carbon emissions within the next 100 months. And the new reactor in Ontario will do nothing towards that. Meanwhile, we'll have diverted money from other options that could be bringing emissions down and building a greener economy in the near term.
Sean Patrick, I want to thank you for your time.
It was a pleasure. Anytime.
Word up. So that was just Robin Yeto, the longtime co-host of Word of Mouth Wednesday, interview there with Patrick Stencil, or Sean Patrick Stencil, speaking about the Greenpeace and the AECL, and we're going to be right back here on the Word of Mouth Wednesday on CKLN.
CKLN Radio will be having a general meeting and elections to its board of directors on Monday, January 31st at 7 p.m. at the Ryerson Student Center, 55 Gould Street. We will be electing 4 volunteer staff and 4 general community members to the board. To be eligible to participate in the meeting, you must be either A, a Ryerson student in a program leading to a degree, diploma, or certificate. B, paid staff of CKLN or volunteer who has performed 6 hours of work within the past 12 months and has signed a volunteer contract. Or C, a general community member who has donated at least $25 to CKLN between January 24, 2010 and January 24, 2011. For more information, please see our website at www.ckln.fm. Again, CKLN is holding its general meeting and board elections on Monday, January 31st at 7 p.m. at the Ryerson Student Center, 55 Gould Street.
Stay connected to family and friends with Telehop. Only $1 for the first 14 minutes to Jamaica. Or call Canada and the U.S. for only $1 for unlimited minutes. Simply dial 1010-620 plus 1, then your long-distance number. For more great rates to other countries, visit telehop.com and start saving today.
1010-620.
Telehop. Satisfaction is everything.
We are opposed to...
Hey, looking for a change?
...by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice.
Published pictures of the prophet to provoke a war. The pen, the sword, the dollar verse, the vocal cord. His speech is free, then what was your 2 cents worth when little sweatshop kids was working on your sweatshirts? And poverty was living next door, you never cared. You had your car, cigar, scotch, and leather chairs. Y'all better stare into oblivion and hold your breath. Prepare for war, brace yourself or hold your death. Fade away, this life ain't really what it used to be. Sacred nature tainted by the CNNs and movie screens. Walk with me down this long, unforgiving road.
chief executive.
Boss and boss, we live by the unwritten code. Off the hook, like flight 93, mobile phones. Think about it while you're freezing in your mobile homes, collecting welfare checks, but that's just paper money. My wealth is intangible, they can't be taken from me. They publish pictures of the prophets to provoke a war. The pen, the sword, the dollar versus the vocal cord. His speech is free, then what was your 2 cents worth when little sweatshop kids was working on your sweatshirts and poverty was living next door? You never cared. You had your car, cigar, scotch, and leather chairs. Y'all better stare into oblivion and hold your breath. Prepare for war, brace yourself or hold your death. Fade away, this life ain't really what it used to be. Sacred nature tainted by the CNNs and movie screens. Walk with me down this long, unforgiving
Pennsylvania
road.
Avenue.
Laws and lies, we live by the unwritten code. Off the hook, like flight 93, mobile phones. Think about it while you're freezing in your mobile home, collecting welfare checks, but that's just paper money. My wealth is intangible and can't be taken from me. Sold down, line after line, sign of the times. The killers in the schoolyard infecting your mind. You're more dead than alive, eating breakfast with swine, chewing through the pig. Hold your breath and it's fine. Life is like a rat race, the blind lead the blind. Get rich and die young, running from the eye in the sky. The fools go where the fools go, be calling their name. They put us down here to paper chase, call it the game, call it insane. Paper chases falling to graves. I know a kid who got killed for a ball of the cane. Welcome to Babylon, where the crooked ones rule and the deceptions passed on through the books in the schools. The system needs victims, got its hooks in the youth. A sucker born every minute, now he's looking for booze. Look at the truth, crack rules, they cooking the proof. There's no justice, no peace, so they got choked in the booth. It goes death to the money makers, pain for the pimps and hoes, peace to the homeless people sleeping out in the snow, death to the corporations, pain through the dollar sign, peace to the secondhand ticking, killing father time, death to the money makers, pain for the pimps and hoes, peace to the homeless people sleeping out in the snow, death to the corporations, pain through the dollar sign, peace to the secondhand ticking, killing father time, death to the money makers, pain for the pimps and hoes, peace to the homeless people sleeping out in the snow, death to the corporations, pain through the dollar sign, peace to the secondhand ticking, killing father time.
Highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised.
Word up, Word of Mouth Wednesday. That was just the System's Override track off the Underground Railroad mixtape, Volume 1. And joining us right now in the studio is a guest from, well, he's been on the show in the past. He's been talking a lot about the G20. You might recognize his voice from such chants as Whose Streets Are Streets, Hey Hey Ho Ho, Bill Blair Has Got to Go, and Public Inquiry. Now, he is a producer, an activist, and he's, well, you know him from The Secret Store or Toronto G20 Exposed.ca. Derek Soberall, how's it going, Derek?
Once again, we're speaking the truth. We're standing up for freedoms in our society. We're speaking the truth because there's a bunch of lies out there, and we've got to smash them one lie at a time.
Right, right. And we're trying to figure, one thing we're trying to figure out is what country this is, because a big headline that's come out is "This Ain't Canada Anymore." And actually, joining us on the phone is a is somebody that was involved with this incident at the G20, where a police officer said that this ain't Canada anymore, and. Paul Figueres. Paul, are you on the line?
I am. How you doing, Daniel?
Oh, not bad. Thanks, Paul, for joining us. And,
hey, my pleasure. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to ask you about this right away, because we've got Derek and Paul here, and you guys were actually both, referenced with this situation, because Derek, you were quoted in the Toronto Star, and I know, Paul, you were interviewed on CBC. Maybe Paul, because you were there, what was your impression? Like, what exactly happened in this incident?
It was, the lead up to it was relatively innocent, just kind of walking down the street. We're walking southbound on University, and then all of a sudden, stopped with a group of my friends by a group of police officers. Led by the one cop that you see in the video, you were just essentially instructed to start opening up your bags, of course when they got to me, as you can see in the video, I didn't feel any reason to open up my bag. I mean, there wasn't I didn't feel like I should have my civil rights violated at that point.
Right, right. And so this whole incident happens, like, it gets intense where your friends, I guess you're with a group, and I think is some of your friends, did they show their bags?
Yes. Yes, they did.
Right, because that's what it seems like. It seems like a few of your friends are showing theirs, and then you're saying that you're not, and then as you're saying that, it seems like there's some large officers are, like, approaching you. They're almost, like, walking you towards, you know, so you're backstepping towards, like, a staircase. It seems like a steep staircase down. It looks like you were on near one of the stations. I think it might be...
Yeah, St. Andrew's Station,
St. Andrew, right.
I mean, essentially, you know, when the officer got to me and asked me to open up my bag, you know, I declined. And they stated that, you know, I wasn't going to consent to a search. At that point, he actually said to me that he said something along the lines, you know, if you're not consenting to a search, then you have to leave the area. And I was actually even ready to comply with him, and you know, and I said, and I was in the process of saying to him, well, okay, I'm not consenting to a search, so I'm going to leave. And I guess he didn't like that answer, because that's when he actually grabbed me and pulled me into him and said, you don't get a choice, buddy. And then just kind of threw me back when he let go of me. And you know, and I was like, well, what are you grabbing me for, man? And then, you know, at that point, it was, of course, it became a very different situation, because, you know, it was an assault, as well as having civil liberties violated.
Right, right, and it's definitely an intense story. Why don't we just play? Here's a bit of a soundbite here of the incident from the YouTube video.
Canada, that's something. Yeah. Saying Canada right now.
What? Oh!
This is in Canada right now.
No.
Wow.
No.
I just don't like to have my civil rights violated.
There's no civil rights here.
So that was two parts of the video there. You heard the part, this ain't Canada right now, and then there's another part where he says there is no civil rights here. Now, when he says this ain't Canada, it is interesting that your friends around there start laughing. Just, I guess it was just because of the situation was so absurd. What did you think when he was saying, you know, this ain't Canada?
Well, I was stunned. I mean, you know, it's certainly when you're involved in a situation and your civil rights are being violated in this way, and you're being violated essentially your civil rights. You know, when you're in the situation, it's one thing as it's physically happening, but then to have it actually even vocalized to that extent, I mean, it was actually stunned. I mean, is the best word I can use for it. That you know, when I heard those words out of the officer's mouth, I mean, it essentially, I was left thinking, wow, you're actually saying that you're suspending civil rights. You know, you've decided. the absurdity of it, the ludicrousness of it is just you know, unbelievable, in my opinion.
Exactly. And this story got out in some major media, and this officer got named, Sergeant Mark Charlebois, I believe, of York Region, badge 817, I think it is.
815,
right? The way that it got out, though, that is an interesting part here, and that's actually an interesting thing to ask Derek about too. Why were you quoted on this incident in the Toronto Star, and how did you get involved with this whole story?
Yeah, I have a YouTube channel called The Secret Store, and I got an email from the Toronto Star, and they were asking me about this video and where it originated from. And I disclosed that information, and they were asking me just the facts of the video and when this took place and so forth. And basically, yeah, I just I got quoted in the Toronto Star. I wanted to help out to get this information out. It's 7 months later, but G20 issues are not dying. We're speaking the truth, and we're getting it out to the public, because freedoms and our civil rights were violated, the most mass violations of Canadian Charter rights in the history of Canada. So, I mean, we have all rights to stand up and to speak for other people. And when Paul is being interrogated there and put into a headlock, that's essentially against the law. And when this Ontario Public Works Act was deemed illegal by the Ontario Ombudsman, it just verifies what we're doing is right, because we're speaking the truth and we need to get to the bottom of it. And I just got emailed, and I sent them some information back, and they wanted me to help them out. And then I got called from the CTV, and they wanted to get in touch with Paul and to do an interview on the National. So I disclosed that information to them as well, because I want to be a part of getting the truth out.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, and that's why I'm glad you're doing the work with the secret story. You're posting a lot of stuff, and the word is getting out. But the original video, if you want to find it, was actually on its YouTube user ToxicWaste26 has the original video posted of this incident. And
he's the one that actually shot the video as well.
Right. So what, Paul, what did you think about the media's portrayal of the situation, and why, you know, were you surprised that this story is getting out, you know, 7 months after the G20?
I'm not surprised. I mean, it was I caught snippets of it. It was picked up last summer on CBC as well. And I think I saw it on City TV as well last summer. I knew that it had been this specific videoed incident. It was referenced in the Ombudsman's report as well. So I had a friend who had made me aware of that when he had taken a look at all the end notes. I wasn't expecting it to be picked up like this, and I had gotten an email from the guy who shot the video when the Toronto Star article came out, and you know, he told me that CBC had been trying to get a hold of him in Toronto Star and asking for my name and stuff, and so I gave them both a call, and that's how the interview happened. Essentially, but you know, I guess I think really what we need is to have all these kinds of stories told and brought out into the mainstream media, because I think there's still among a great portion of the general public, there's still a lot of misconceptions, and rightfully so, because there's a lot of misinformation that's come out of different government agencies regarding G20. So. The more of these kinds of videos that we get out there, so the general public can actually see, hey, this is what really happened. The better chance we have of people really decrying these types of actions.
For real, yeah. And I guess one thing that I wanted to ask you about, just because you know all these articles that have come out about the situation haven't really talked about it, and it is something it's very apparent when you watch the video, and this is because I've been watching this, you know, I've seen this clip since the G20 on YouTube. It's all over YouTube, and the one characteristic that people notice when they see you on the video is your T-shirt. It says "Animal Liberation, Human Liberation," I think. I guess basically I just want to ask you about what this movement is, and like, is that why you were down there protesting?
Absolutely. I was down there. I was down there essentially for the whole week with different groups of people, and we were basically bringing the animal liberation, animal rights message to the G20, essentially because a lot of what was being what was being discussed at the G20, of course, were the austerity measures, and most of the groups that were down there, certainly had really important messages, but they were all essentially human-centered messages, and the one thing that we wanted to bring focus to and to have people recognize is that there's essentially a whole huge number of individuals, of beings who are constantly not just under these austerity measures, they're constantly being enslaved, they're constantly being killed for food, being killed for their skins. I think our figures right now for land animals that are killed for food worldwide is something around 53 billion. Which is an unbelievable number, you know. So that was essentially the message that we were trying to get attention drawn to.
Exactly, yeah, and that's why I'm glad that you're able to get some of the message out, and that's why I'm glad. Part of why I'm glad that you know, that the this video is being seen by a lot of people now, you know, because at least if they're not going to talk about your, you know, the reasons for protesting, at least people can see visually, you know, you've got the T-shirt on. There is more issues other than, you know, yelling at police officers, which is what they, you know, a lot of people have tried to paint the protests as, you know, which is, I think there's
absolutely. For anyone who is actually, you know, in the area and on the ground, so to speak, for the most part, everyone that I saw was really respectful and peaceful, and, you know, even in the face of such, you know, an immense police presence and so many transgressions by the police on the ground. I mean, you know, it really is a credit to the character of the vast majority of the protesters that they did kind of keep their cool in the face of such unbelievable kind of circumstances.
For real, yeah. And Paul, that's why I'm glad you kept your cool. You can see it in the video. You know, in the face of the intimidation of these G20 security. Well. I'm glad you got through it. I'm glad that some words are getting out, and thanks a lot, Paul, for joining us. Derek, did you have any questions for Paul?
Yeah, I'd just like to ask Paul, like, you're aware of the law, the enact, it's called the Ontario Public Works Act, was deemed illegal by the Ombudsman, but also the police chief admitted that the 5 meters never existed. So here we have compliancy where the police are actually lying to the public. And even beforehand, we have video evidence of police officers not having their identification badges. So they're asking us for identification and want to search our bags. But under the Canadian Constitution, we have legal rights, which is everyone has the right to be secure against unreasonable search or seizure. So being put in that circumstance, now knowing what the law was, what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, well, that's absolutely that's a great point you're bringing up. And if you when you take a look at the video, the one that I'm involved in that we're talking about right now, you see that the officer in question and the accompanying officers, none of them were wearing name tags. But there was so much misinformation and certainly Chief Blair was at the center of a lot of this, because we now know that, for example, the 5 meter rule that was touted throughout the week never actually existed. You know, be that as it may, the vast majority of incidents happened way beyond any fictitious five meter area of defense. It's really an indictment of the way the system was kind of set up, that these transgressions were able to occur, that there was very little public outcry at the time, and it was just a really infamous kind of situation.
For real, yeah. Thanks a lot, Paul, for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much, Daniel, and thanks for covering this.
Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah, and that's Paul Figueres from, Animal Liberation, Human Liberation, and the G20 protests. Search for This Ain't Canada or This Isn't Canada Anymore. You can find the video on YouTube. You can find it on Toxic Waste 26 or The Secret Store, or, you know, a lot of channels now have it linked up. So you'll be able to find that kind of info, and that's why, you know, it's also great to have Derek on the show, studio here. And what I wanted to get into, though, just because this is a major speech, and we had this mentioned last week. It was recommended in the interview last week with Tohoki Tote, who mentioned that one of the best speeches of all time, what might be the best speech of all time, was by John F. Kennedy. And it took place in April 1961. It's called President and the Press. So this is about 50 years ago. And does John F. Kennedy's words to the American Newspapers Publicists Association, which took place in Waldorf Astoria Hotel, New York, New York, does the president 50 years ago, does his words, are his words worthwhile for everyone in 2011? Well, I think so, and that's why we're going to play the speech. And then I think afterwards we're gonna come back. Hopefully, have a few minutes to talk about it. But just to give a brief intro. Derek, did you want to mention anything before we played, or should we just go into it and
yeah, I have a quote here that everybody needs to know. And I mean, we're speaking up. We got voices, and the truth cannot be stopped. So I mean, this is Toronto, the greatest city on earth. We believe that we're going to take back our city, and we're just going to stand up for people's rights. You know, when they're taken away, we have every right to speak the truth. And there's a quote here. It says, "Those who give up essential freedom to obtain a little security deserve neither freedom nor security. I'm sure they just love folks who are willing to give up their rights because they live in fear. Well, we're sending a message that we're not going to live in fear, and we're going to hold people accountable. We believe in justice and transparency, and we're going to hold people to that."
For real. Here is the President and the press. Word of mouth Wednesday.
Gentlemen, I appreciate very much your generous invitation to be here tonight. You bear heavy responsibilities these days. And an article I read some time ago reminded me of how particularly heavily the burdens of present-day events bear upon your profession. You may remember that in 1851, New York Herald Tribune, under the sponsorship and publishing of Horace Greeley, employed as its London correspondent an obscure journalist by the name of Karl Marx. We are told that foreign correspondent Marx, stone broke, and with a family ill and undernourished, constantly appealed to Greeley and managing editor Charles Dana for an increase in his munificent salary of $5 per installment, a salary which he and Ingalls ungratefully labeled as the lousiest petty bourgeois cheating. But when all his financial appeals were refused, Marx looked around for other means of livelihood and fame, eventually terminating his relationship with the Tribune and devoting his talents full time to the cause that would bequeath to the world the seeds of Leninism, Stalinism, revolution, and the Cold War. If only this capitalistic New York newspaper had... had treated him more kindly. If only Marx had remained a foreign correspondent, history might have been different. And I... I hope all publishers will bear this lesson in mind the next time they receive a poverty-stricken appeal from a small increase in the expense account from an obscure newspaper man. I have selected as the title of my remarks tonight, "The President and the Press." Some may suggest that this would be more naturally worded, "The President versus the Press," but those are not my sentiments tonight. It is true, however, that when a well-known diplomat from another country demanded recently that our State Department repudiate certain newspaper attacks on his colleagues, it was unnecessary for us to reply that this administration was not responsible for the press had already made it clear that it was not responsible for this administration. Nevertheless, my purpose here tonight is not to deliver the usual assault on the so-called one-party press. On the contrary, in recent months, I have rarely heard any complaints about political bias in the press except from a few Republicans. Nor is it my purpose tonight to discuss or defend the televising of presidential press conferences. I think it is highly beneficial to have some 20 million Americans regularly sit in on these conferences to observe, if I may say so, the incisive, the intelligent, and the courteous qualities displayed by your Washington correspondents. Nor, finally, are these remarks intended to examine the proper degree of privacy which the press should allow to any president and his family. If, in the last few months, your White House reporters and photographers have been attending church services with regularity, that has surely done them no harm. On the other hand, I realize that your staff and wire service photographers may be complaining that they do not enjoy the same green privileges, the local golf courses, which they once did. It is true that my predecessor did not object, as I do, to pictures of one's golfing skill in action, but neither, on the other hand, did he ever been a Secret Service man. My topic tonight is a more sober one, of concern to publishers as well as editors. I want to talk about our common responsibilities in the face of a common danger. The events of recent weeks may have helped to illuminate that challenge for some, but the dimensions of its threat have loomed large on the horizon for many years. Whatever our hopes may be for the future, for reducing this threat or living with it, there is no escaping either the gravity or the totality of its challenge to our survival and to our security. A challenge that confronts us in unaccustomed ways in every sphere of human activity. This deadly challenge imposes upon our society two requirements of direct concern, both to the press and to the president. Two requirements that may seem almost contradictory in tone, but which must be reconciled and fulfilled if we are to meet this national peril. I refer first to the need for far greater public information, and second, to the need for far greater official secrecy. The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society, and we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. But I do ask, every publisher, every editor, and every newsman in the nation to re-examine his own standards and to recognize the nature of our country's peril. In time of war, the government and the press have customarily joined in an effort based largely on self-discipline to prevent unauthorized disclosures to the enemy. In times of clear and present danger, the courts have held that even the privileged rights of the First Amendment must yield to the public's need for national security. Today, no war has been declared, and however fierce the struggle may be, it may never be declared in the traditional fashion. Our way of life is under attack. Those who make themselves our enemy are advancing around the globe. The survival of our friends is in danger. And yet no war has been declared. No borders have been crossed by marching troops. No missiles have been fired. If the press is awaiting a declaration of war before it imposes the self-discipline of combat conditions, then I can only say that no war ever posed a greater threat to our security. If you are awaiting a finding of clear and present danger, then I can only say that the danger has never been more clear and its presence has never been more imminent. It requires a change in outlook, a change in tactics, a change in missions by the government, by the people, by every businessman or labor leader, and by every newspaper. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. It conducts the Cold War in short, with a wartime discipline no democracy would ever hope or wish to match. Nevertheless, every democracy recognizes the necessary restraints of national security. And the question remains whether those restraints need to be more strictly observed if we are to oppose this kind of attack as well as outright invasion. For the facts of the matter are that this nation's foes have openly boasted of acquiring through our newspapers information they would otherwise hire agents to acquire through theft, bribery, or espionage, that details of this nation's covert preparations to counter the enemy's covert operations have been available to every newspaper reader, friend and foe alike, that the size, the strength, the location, and the nature of our forces and weapons, and our plans and strategy for their use, have all been pinpointed in the press and other news media to a degree sufficient to satisfy any foreign power, and that in at least one case, the publication of details concerning a secret mechanism whereby satellites were followed required its alteration at the expense of considerable time and money. The newspapers which printed these stories were loyal, patriotic, responsible, and well-meaning. Had we been engaged in open warfare, they undoubtedly would not have published such items. But in the absence of open warfare, they recognized only the tests of journalism and not the tests of national security. And my question tonight is whether additional tests should not now be adopted. That question is for you alone to answer. No public official should answer it for you. No governmental plan should impose its restraints against your will. But I would be failing in my duty to the nation in considering all of the responsibilities that we now bear and all of the means at hand to meet those responsibilities if I did not commend this problem to your attention and urge its thoughtful consideration. On many earlier occasions, I have said, and your newspapers have constantly said, that these are times that appeal to every citizen's sense of sacrifice and self-discipline. They call out to every citizen to weigh his rights and comforts against his obligations to the common good. I cannot now believe that those citizens who serve in the newspaper business consider themselves exempt from that appeal. I have no intention of establishing a new office of war information to govern the flow of news. I am not suggesting any new forms of censorship or new types of security classifications. I have no easy answer to the dilemma that I have posed and would not seek to impose it if I had one. But I am asking the members of the newspaper profession and the industry in this country to re-examine their own responsibilities, to consider the degree and the nature of the present danger, and to heed the duty of self-restraint, which that danger imposes upon us all. Every newspaper now asks itself, with respect to every story, is it news? All I suggest is that you add the question, is it in the interest of national security? And I hope that every group in America, unions and businessmen and public officials at every level, will ask the same question of their endeavors and subject their actions to this same exacting test. And should the press of America consider and recommend the voluntary assumption of specific new steps or machinery, I can assure you that we will cooperate wholeheartedly with those recommendations. Perhaps there will be no recommendations. Perhaps there is no answer to the dilemma faced by a free and open society in a cold and secret war. In times of peace, any discussion of this subject and any action that results are both painful and without precedent. But this is a time of peace and peril which knows no precedent in history. It is the unprecedented nature of this challenge that also gives rise to your second obligation, an obligation which I share. And that is our obligation to inform and alert the American people, to make certain that they possess all the facts that they need and understand them as well, the perils, the prospects, the purposes of our program, and the choices that we face. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence in the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors. For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news, for it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security, and we intend to do it. It was early in the 17th century that Francis Bacon remarked on three recent inventions already transforming the world: the compass, gunpowder, and the printing press. Now the links between the nations, first forged by the compass, have made us all citizens of the world, the hopes and threats of one becoming the hopes and threats of us all. In that one world's effort to live together, the evolution of gunpowder to its ultimate limit has warned mankind of the terrible consequences of failure. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength. and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
Free and independent, word up, CKLN 88.1 FM, broadcasting from Ryerson University in Toronto. That was the speech to the press, the president and the press. It was a speech by John F. Kennedy. It took place April 27th, 1961. President and the Press to the American Newspapers Publishers Association. And you can find the whole speech, 19 minutes, 12 seconds, at the presidential recording section of the website, archive.org. And that was the complete speech. President John F. Kennedy in that speech was talking a lot about secrets, a lot about government secrets, and that's what I mentioned was a main topic of today's show. And that is something that I wanted to ask Derek. We still got Derek Soberall in the studio. What are your thoughts here on that, one of the greatest speeches of all time, and this whole issue of secrets in the government? Derek, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I'm thinking sometimes we need to anchor public opinion, just as John F. Kennedy suggested. We need free choices, and dissenters cannot be silenced. We need debate, we need criticism, and we definitely need a free and open society more than ever. We need our voices to be heard. We have the freedom of press, we have the freedom of speech, we have the freedom of assembly. So let's use those voices. And we need to stand up when things are going wrong in our cities, when we're being lied to, when laws are passed in secret, when we have secret meetings such as the G20, which publicly wasn't broadcasted. Fences dividing people, elite versus the citizens of Toronto, businesses being closed, the Sky Dome and the CN Tower essentially not even in service.
And that's what the Ombudsman of Ontario gets into in the Caught in the Act report. He starts talking about how, and he doesn't actually get into it that much, and he even briefly mentioned it during the press conference, but he said it was a whole separate issue. He didn't want to elaborate on it. But when you actually look into this whole situation with the G20, the Public Works Protection Act was put in fraudulently for the reason that they put it in to protect the G20 leaders, the actual people that were attending the meeting, not to actually protect any public works. That's why they had built a fence and hired all these security guards to protect the actual public works. The actual act, you know, was a major part of the fraud, because it was supposed to be protecting infrastructure from World War II, and they put it in to protect people in 2011, and the whole thing, that's why I think they could have put in the secret law, but they should have called it at least Private Works Protection Act, because the whole thing is a private meeting. Like, we don't know actually what happened to G20, and it's not shown, it's not broadcast, there's no, you know, they let the journalists in only for some press conference speeches after the actual meeting. You know, it seems like a private meeting. That's what Kennedy's getting into in that speech too, with
exactly.
All the secret societies, secret meetings. And we actually, the reason that this speech was brought up by Tohoki Tokte on the show last week was, I was talking about Rob Ford, and I mentioned that Rob Ford had a major campaign pledge when he was campaigning, the current mayor of Toronto, that there would be no secret meetings and no secret deals when he's mayor. And I thought that was, you know, that's pretty hopeful. That sounds, you know, almost like what JFK is speaking about. What are your thoughts, Derek, on 2011, secrets in the government, secrets in Toronto? Like, how many secrets are there? You know, what are you thinking?
There's tons of secrets. There's lots of conflicts of interest. We're going to see where this money went in the summer, where the G20 billion dollars was spent. We're going to see some heads roll. And we're keeping ourselves informed. We're knowledgeable. We're truth seekers. And it's up to us to bring the stories to the mainstream public. It's up to us to do our own investigation sometimes. And that's why it's about connecting people, connecting stories, writing blogs, doing YouTube channels, writing articles, and getting it out to editors. Everybody has an oath here that we got to actually get out the information, and sometimes we have to do the due diligence to get it out. So if you have a concern, if you care about something, don't be afraid to speak up, because we need people to speak up more than ever.
Exactly. Yeah, Derek, thanks a lot for being on the show. Derek, where can people get more info? What's the website again?
Yeah, they can go to my website. It's on YouTube, The Secret Store. The secrets are free. I don't charge for them, but that's where you can go. That's
awesome.
The corporation.
Awesome. Yeah, check out The Secret Store. The G20 has been exposed. Well, we've re-exposed the G20 tonight. This has been our Wednesday word of mouth for the January the 26th of 2011. We're still speaking on the G20, still talking on a lot of issues. On the AECL, we were talking with Sean Patrick Stencil. That was Robin Yento sent in that interview. And then also want to thank Paul Figueres for speaking to us about this whole G20 and how this ain't Canada anymore. Well, my name's Daniel Libby, and thanks a lot for listening to the Word of Mouth Wednesday. Stay tuned for more content here on CKLN with the Blues Dr. Julie Hill, who's up next with the Blue Remedy. Stay cool, word up, word is bond. I should say stay warm in this winter chill. Again, my name's Daniel Libby, and peace out. Much respect. Keep it real. Word up.